Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
From the New School in Greenwich Village, this is a special edition of the Brian Lehrer Show on the viability of the middle class in the New York metro area. Which is the better way to make housing affordable in New York City? Rent regulations and lots of government housing subsidies, or lots more mass transit to the outer boroughs and let the market take care of the rent? Is Mayor Bloomberg's anti-poverty experiment working? Is it missing an effort to reduce single parenting? We'll ask those questions and others to New York City Deputy Mayor Dennis Walcott, Dan Cantor, co-chair of the Working Families Party, Nicole Gelinas, senior fellow with the Manhattan Institute, a contributor to their publication, The City Journal, and a columnist for the New York Post and New York Sun, and Andrea Batista Schlesinger, executive director of the Drum Major Institute for Public Policy. Please welcome all our guests. Nicole Gelinas, let's jump right in on what I understand is one of your ideas, and I mentioned it last hour. You say, forget housing policy per se, build great mass transit to the outer boroughs, and affordable housing will follow. Do I have that right?
Sure, and here's why. The city can never, ever, ever win the battle against the market to provide enough subsidized housing for everyone who would want it. And for example, Mayor Bloomberg's plan to build 165,000 units of subsidized housing would provide housing perhaps for 500,000 city residents. That's about 0.5% of all of the people who live in the city. All this does is raise costs for everyone else. You're taking some supply artificially off the market. And who pays for this? It's the other middle class people who aren't lucky enough to be in this 5%. The best thing the mayor can do for housing is, one, cut costs across the board, and that includes cutting property taxes, taxes for big landlords who pay 4 to 7 times as much per dollar on their investments and then have to pass those costs down to their tenants, and also build mass transit to the outer borough neighborhoods that right now it takes an hour and more one way to commute to places like Jamaica, Queens, Flushing, Queens, Gravesend, Brooklyn, many parts of Staten Island have virtually no public transportation. These are working class and middle class neighborhoods that need to be connected better to Manhattan. And what would happen is if the city invested in the infrastructure, the market would sort itself out. We would have working class neighborhoods, middle class neighborhoods, upper class neighborhoods, and a mix within those neighborhoods, older housing stock, luxury housing stock, and housing stock in between. That is the only way to build middle-class housing. If we go the other way, try to build housing for the lucky 5%, it's just an irrational system. Who decides who gets to be in that 5% when there are millions and millions and millions of people, not just in New York already, but all over the country and all over the world, really, who would love to have an affordable apartment in New York City? There's no rational way to allocate those resources.
Why not based on need or income?
Because there are millions and millions of people, really in the world, billions of people who would qualify for affordable New York apartments. Who do you give it to?
If they live in Dakar, you don't give it to them.
Well, they might come here once they learn that we are providing it.
Deputy Mayor Walcott, does that model work for you?
No, not at all. Not surprisingly, but I think I have to put a disclaimer on the show to start out with. I'm not sure if it's a wise policy on my part. To be here going head-to-head with the mayor, who's on another radio show literally at this moment. So I want all of you to deny that I was here and you don't hear me on the radio, so I'm not going head-to-head with my boss.
Personally, I never met you.
I know. Thank you very much. Now, going to the policy itself, I don't think you have to do one to the exclusion of the other. I think you have to have a combination of both, and what the mayor has talked about is a combination of policies. And what's been talked about as far as the expansion of mass transit, we have been actively talking about about the expansion of mass transit, both from the number 7 line, the 2nd Avenue line, taking a look at mass transit from bus routes, having express buses into the city. And obviously what the mayor's been talking about over the last several months with congestion pricing and the reduction of use of cars, I mean, all that is in combination to really deal with affordability and access to areas throughout the 5 boroughs of New York City. When we talk about the, I think, very aggressive plan that the mayor put forward as far as the building of affordable housing, and I think the work of a combination of our agencies in collaboration together as far as how we identify the land in the city, I think it's a very aggressive plan, as indicated, though correctly so. We're talking about possibly 500,000 people benefiting from this plan. These are 500,000 people that would not have benefited without the mayor having a very aggressive plan in place. And I think under the mayor's leadership and Deputy Mayor Dr. Ruff's leadership, we've been able to put a plan in place, and we're seeing the results of those policies already. In addition to that, I mean, part of the combination of work doing between the city agencies is what we recently announced about a joint venture between the New York City Housing Authority and HPD, and taking a look at some of the vacant land that's owned by the Housing Authority and how we maximize that land to build affordable housing there, I think, is extremely important. So I don't think one has to be done in exclusion of another, and I think really what we have to do is capitalize on an opportunity of having the mayor in place and making sure that we're building units and then follow up on that.
So, Nicole, let me go back to you. Why not do both? Lots of infrastructure and affordable housing.
By definition, a program that gives 500,000 people out of 8.1 and possibly in 15 years, almost 9 million people, this is favoring some people over others arbitrarily and irrationally. The best way to spend all of the resources that we have is to create a fair playing field for renters, for owners, for developers, for people who are already in New York City, and for people who would like to move here.
But we heard in the last hour that Mayor Franklin has no rent regulation program, rent subsidy program in Atlanta, and yet it sounds like they have a lot of the same urban affordable housing issues that we do. How do you explain that?
One thing that rent stabilization has done in New York is it prevents tenants, say you started out in New York City, you needed a big apartment, you rented one 30 years ago. Now you've downsized, your kids have grown up, moved away. You still have a large apartment, but you cannot move into a smaller apartment. The supply is completely frozen in place. You'll have an immigrant family who's just coming in, starting out, stuck in a studio or a one-bedroom apartment.
But that's our particular New York system, and I don't want to turn this too much into a debate of the old rent stabilization laws, but you know, we heard in Atlanta that they don't have anything like that, and they have a similar kind of problem, which seems to indicate that the market, left to its own, is not providing.
The markets, the rent stabilization, I can't speak to Atlanta specifically, but all it has done is taken 1 million housing units in New York City, one-third of the supply, off the market. It's no surprise that the prices of the other 2 million are higher. In cities in general, Atlanta, New York, of course, as more affluent people move to the city, they want to be a part of the city, prices will go up. But that does not mean that New York will be a city of the rich. In fact, it's not. 92% of the people who live in New York City would qualify for the mayor's affordable housing plan. They're here already. By definition, they're affording to live here, even if it is sometimes difficult for many of them. The idea of the government allocating these resources does not solve the problem. It really makes the extremes of the problem worse.
Let me stay with you on this model for just one more minute. And on the other part of it, it sounds like you want the government of the city to spend more on mass transit infrastructure. This is where you're for more government, more than is even proposed in the Plan YC 2030 proposal?
I would spend more dollars and more efficiently. You know, Congressman Anthony Weiner, and he might be surprised to hear me giving him a compliment, but he has said something to the effect of, by a certain date, I can't remember if he said 2025 or 2030, he would like everyone in New York City, in the 5 boroughs, to have a 45-minute commute. And I think that's an excellent goal to aim for. And that would give landlords who might build middle-class housing on their own out in places like Coney Island, further along the train lines, a signal to say, in a few years, we're getting high-speed mass transit, rapid transit buses. Let's start building, and let's rezone some of these neighborhoods so that people can build denser, and we'll get more affordable housing for more than the lucky 5%.
Deputy Mayor Walcott, on that, Congressman Weiner says that I interviewed Transportation Committee Chairman John Liu from the City Council recently. He was trying to demand a 30-minute commute from anywhere in Queens in order to support the congestion pricing proposal. Is this feasible? Can we have, let's say, 30, 45 minutes as a maximum mass transit commute from anywhere in New York City to the center?
I think it's a laudable goal. I mean, I happen to live in southeast Queens, so I'm at the furthest point as far as Queens is concerned in commuting into Manhattan. And in taking mass transit, I would love to have a commute that's 30 to 45 minutes. I think what Plan NYC talks about is how we get to that particular point and sets very, I think, ambitious targets for us to achieve. I think the thing that's, to me, extremely important, not just with Plan NYC and congestion pricing, it also has a direct effect on the environment as well. And I think one of the beneficial impacts of what we're talking about is how we reduce environmental hazards throughout the city, especially in poorer neighborhoods. And so I think in combination of that, I think more we can do to produce people to go to mass transit, I think the better off the city, the economy, but more importantly, the environment will be.
Dan Cantor, founding executive director of the Working Families Party. Who is middle class in New York? Who are we talking about when we use that term? And who are we not talking about? Nicole just said, what was it, 85% of the people of New York?
92% of families.
Would qualify under some kind of affordable housing subsidy, under the mayor's plan, at least in theory. So who are we talking about when we talk about middle class in New York, and who are we not talking about?
Well, everybody has their own definition. One that I've seen that sort of makes sense is people who, the 2.5 million taxpayers between, let's say, $50,000 and $150,000 per year. There's another 2+ million below $50,000, and there's a tiny segment above that. There are about 44,000 taxpayers in New York City who earn more than $20,000 a week. They make as much money as the entire middle class. So we need to back up for a moment and say we live in the most unequal country of the industrialized countries. We live in the most unequal state. And we live in the most unequal city.
Does that matter? Does it matter that there are some people who are very, very rich? Does that hurt the middle class?
Yeah, absolutely it does. What made the great American middle class after World War II were two things, basically. One was the rise of unionization, and two were high marginal tax rates to keep the top from getting too far out of whack. Because when it's too far out of whack, we're not in the same boat. Very wealthy people buy their way out of having to take the subways, the public schools. Everybody knows this. In Nicole's world, the market shall rule and everything will turn out okay. In the real world, we need to pay attention to what kind of city we want to have.
But if we have good public education, if we have good mass transit, what does it matter if some people are buying their way out?
Because we're either in this together or we're not. So you just have to make a decision. It's a legitimate view to think it's okay. We should all live in gated communities. That's sort of, the Republican vision of heaven. It's the New York vision of hell. It's our vision, my vision of hell with Rudy Giuliani at the gatehouse, right? So this is, you have to make a decision. And the decision we've made in New York historically.
We heard endorsements in the last hour, now we heard an unendorsement.
You have to make a decision. The decision we've made in New York, what makes New York great is everybody's here. And you like being around people different than yourself. If we go to this kind of, psychotic market-only system, we'll have New York will be like Paris with the rich people in the center, everybody else pressed up against the glass. And I don't think it's what people want. It's certainly not what tenants want. There's legislation right now that the mayor is supporting up in Albany to take the Mitchell Llamas, put them right into rent stabilization. We need to do some things right now to stop the bleeding.
But
otherwise,
does making rich people less rich, does taking money away from people who are swimming in all this hedge fund money accomplish that for the 92%?
It certainly helps. I mean, if you have more money and more public goods, better schools, I don't know where we're going to get the money to pay for this mass transit build-out if all we do is allow, the ever reduction of taxes on the high end. I mean, we need to have a balance, as the deputy mayor is saying, but you need to step back and first make a decision. What is the goal? What is the role of the state? What's the role of the government? We live in a capitalist society. There's going to be great inequality. But the role of the government is to mitigate that and make it possible for ordinary people. You know, your life chances should not be determined at birth.
Deputy Mayor Wolcott, how much do you agree with that model?
Well, obviously working for a capitalist. I was listening to the first part of the discussion with the mayors and Esther and Tom Suozzi, and they were talking about Mayor Bloomberg. I think one of the things about Mayor Bloomberg that people really haven't gotten a sense of is the passion of the mayor for some of the people that Dan was just talking about. And that goes to, when we probably talk about this a little later on, our Commission on Equal Economic Opportunity and what that means in addressing the issues of poverty in the city and how we really address those issues by targeting dollars for certain programs to make sure that people have the ability to earn more income and also providing incentives, which I understand at times with different people are very controversial with our conditional cash transfer programs. And that, to me, is something that's merit of discussion as well. But I think working for the capitalist, one of the key things is how we spread the wealth around, and spreading the wealth around meaning let the marketplace drive a lot of what's going on in New York City. And one of the things, again, living in Queens, and I'm noticing this even in my own neighborhood, is the patterns of migration of individuals to different neighborhoods and how we're spreading out throughout the entire city. And what I mean by that is that there are no longer really white neighborhoods, black neighborhoods, Latino neighborhoods. The neighborhoods are changing. The demographic patterns of different ethnic groups who are moving in is changing every day. We have an increasing, and not just, you can't say a Latino population, but a Mexican population, obviously a very Caribbean population. Several houses on my block just changed ownership, and native-born blacks have now gone back to the South, possibly to Atlanta. And then you have new immigrants who are Haitian and Jamaican moving in. And to me, that goes to the richness that Dan was talking about of the New York City where we're all together. But at the same time, we have to have policies that government puts in place and policies that deal with, I think, the ability of people to gain access to the mainstream, to gain access to the middle class, to provide the supports as they gain entry to the middle class, whether it's through affordable housing or eventually when we talk about education, and how that provides a platform for individuals to have the ability to earn more dollars and be self-sufficient.
Aren't you saying that New York City is not functionally segregated in housing anymore?
No, I think we're moving away from the segregated patterns that existed in New York City. We can still, I mean, I'm not going to sit here and say we're totally away from that. You can still ride the subways, and you get off certain stops, and you know who's getting off those stops. And, I mean, it's still the migratory pattern of where people settle. But I see a very significant change of patterns of where people are living right now. And it's not just gentrification. Again, I see more whites moving back into Queens. I see more whites in Bedford-Stuyvesant. I see greater Mexican population spreading. I see Haitians. I mean, so I see a mixture happening more and more across the city, but still you still have your very segregated communities. And the goal is, and I think that's part of what we're talking about today, how we expand where people live and provide access for the middle class throughout the five boroughs and not in certain neighborhoods.
Andrea Batista. Lisa Schlesinger from the Drum Major Institute for Public Policy. I think your main concern in your group is helping the aspiring working class attain middle class status. Do you see the same population patterns as Deputy Mayor Wolcott was just describing, and in as positive a way?
Well, the first thing is that we should all reflect on the fact that this is an interesting conversation, because it's one that especially people who are concerned with fairness and with equity weren't having for a long time, which is, what do we do about the middle class? That was perhaps too bourgeois a concern until I think we began to realize that these issues are on a continuum. And so challenges to accessing, for example, CUNY, different policy set of questions, but the same principle behind that middle class parent who's also struggling, you know, to send, you know, his or her child to college when public university tuition for four-year schools is increasing 30% since Bush took office. So they come from the same set of questions and the same set of decisions, and really that's what public policy is, a set of decisions. So, you know, I think now we're at the point where we understand that you can't solve poverty unless you figure out how to make a city livable for someone who's middle class, because there is no being poor or not poor. You have to be not poor means that you're something else. And if that thing isn't livable, then that strategy is incomplete.
So that means low crime rates. That means functional public schools. That means good public transportation. Any other basic building blocks to that?
Sure. I think you need to look at this as K through 16. You know, it's not just about good public schools. It then is how do you go on to get the education and training that you need. You know, I think when you're talking about the middle class, and I just want to underscore what Dan said, that, you know, the middle class is not a naturally occurring phenomenon. It was created through progressive public policy, which is why it's so upsetting that for a long time those who consider ourselves progressive stopped talking about and talking to the middle class. You know, this idea of Nicole's that, you know, which I really think is kind of that comes from the Department of False Choices, that government either has to do everything or nothing, flies in the face of everything we know about the historical creation of the middle class, which is key to your question.
But you're saying without government intervention, there would be no middle class.
Absolutely.
In a world left to market forces.
Absolutely.
Play that out for us. Why should we believe that?
Do you want me to? It's playing out. I haven't been to Brazil.
Look at countries that don't have the kinds of policies Andrea is talking about, that don't allow workers to actually organize to advance their interests collectively, that don't invest in public goods largely consumed by children, otherwise known as schools, that don't believe in libraries. I mean, these are places that tend to have plutocracy.
We are late for a break, so we're going to take that break. But as soon as we come back from it, we will let Nicole Gelinas respond to that and tell us if market forces left to their own devices would create a middle class, in her opinion. Then we'll talk some about the mayor's education plan, which Deputy Mayor Walcott has a big hand in, and much more. Stay with us, Brian Lehrer from the New School, as we continue with our special edition on the viability of the middle class in New York. Stay with us. This is a rebroadcast from a previous Brian Lehrer show, so we can't take your phone calls, but our comment box is always open. Go to WNYC.org and click on Brian Lehrer Show. From the New School in Greenwich Village, this is a special edition of the Brian Lehrer Show on the viability of the middle class in the New York metro area. With me, Dan Cantor, founding executive director of the Working Families Party, Nicole Gelinas, senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute, Andrea Batista Schlesinger, executive director of the Drum Major Institute for Public Policy, and New York City Deputy Mayor Dennis Walcott. I don't want to get too bogged down on the big, abstract, global question of whether the market would create a working class or not, but it was put on the table that way. Nicole Gelinas, would it?
First of all, there are people who should be helped with housing, and those are people who cannot work, people who are physically and mentally disabled to the point, or elderly, that they cannot work. And we have a compassionate society, but beyond compassion, we have an opportunity society. And for really nearly a century here in New York City, we've been following Dan's advice, taxing the rich heavily. Something like 1% of our taxpayers pay 30-35% of our city taxes. And what that policy has done has hollowed the middle class out of the city. We essentially take money from the wealthy and the middle class and give it to the poor. And what this has done, it has resulted in the disappearance of middle class jobs. And this is how. If you are an executive at a bank or a hedge fund or a private equity company, you are saying, if I have high six-figure, seven-figure, and even eight-figure earners, these people are rainmakers. They're bringing in much more than they make in salary to the firm, and we can afford to keep their job in New York City, in Manhattan, because an extra few thousand dollars for the extra money in commercial rent cost, all of the taxes that we levy on upper middle income, and rich people are worth it for that particular person. But if you are looking at a person who's making five figures or even in the low six figures, you're saying, I just can't afford to keep this job in New York City anymore. And in fact, we've seen Citibank say they're going to move some jobs from New York City up to Buffalo. We see offshoring of middle income jobs overseas. And what happens is if you are in the working class, you finish high school, you go to college, you go to community college, you try to get an entry-level job in the city and move your way up, it's much harder to do that today than it was 40, 30 years ago. Really? Those jobs are no longer in New York City, they're elsewhere. So what happens is you move away. The middle class moves from New York so that it can be middle class.
Real briefly, Andrea, why not? Mm-hmm.
Well, I just want to also pose that for some reason there's a concern about those middle-class jobs, but then there are the middle-class jobs like people who are teachers and firefighters and people who are struggling and police officers who are struggling to afford to live in this city, yet there isn't the same amount of concern that they can earn middle incomes that and afford to live here. I just wonder why the discrepancy. Is it because they're from unions?
Nicole, one more time.
Of course, those are middle-class jobs as well, but the problem is that the taxes on the city and state level are so high right now, in part to support very, very high salaries and pension benefits that are much more generous than are available in the private sector now, that we are crowding out private sector jobs. If you are an entrepreneur, say you hope to start a software company, you want to hire maybe 5-10 employees, you yourself hope to take home maybe $90,000, $130,000 if you're doing well. If you locate your company in New York City, you are paying $10,000 a year just to make that decision. It's no surprise that many of the businesses that could help to diversify our economy away from Wall Street decide to locate themselves in places like Houston, in parts of Florida, in Nevada, where there are no such onerous income taxes on entrepreneurs. Yeah. It's certainly good to have good middle-class jobs, teachers, nurses, firefighters, and so forth, but we have done that in the city to the exclusion of the creation of good private sector jobs.
Let's take a question from the audience that I think is on this point. Where is that person? All the way over there on that side. Hello.
We used to talk about affordable and public housing for the working poor, and now here we are talking about it for the middle class as a way to bring it back into the city. Where does that leave the poor? We've seen before the wealthy dislocate the middle class. How do we now make space for the middle class and lower class to coexist in the urban city center? How do we not forget those living below the poverty line in the interest of bringing back the middle class?
Deputy Mayor?
Well, let me, if I may, just touch on a point that Nicole ended on in talking about private sector versus government sector jobs. And I think what we've been able to do is create a combination of both government sector, but more importantly, diverse private sector job opportunities, both at the entry level as well as the mid-range level as well. I think part of the mayor's plan is to make sure that the economy has an economy that's diverse and robust, so that way people can gain access to the middle class through the private sector, more importantly, than government sector, and not be totally reliant on government sector like in the past the New York City economy has been dependent on. Now, dealing with the issue of housing, especially the housing through the public housing stock, well, we've made a significant investment in the investment of the infrastructure of public housing, and also, even though what Esther said was correct in the last panel, that Section 8 has dried up, we have been able to stockpile some Section 8 housing and open it up. And quite frankly, we opened it up, I guess, around 2 months ago, where there was some limited Section 8 to open it up for people to get into public housing. And I think through the NYCHA system, New York City Housing Authority, in combination with HPD, again, we're trying to diversify the housing stock. So that way, one of the things we recently announced, again, is a $50 million plan where we're going to have some of NYCHA-owned property turn into affordable housing units. And as a result of that, and having the availability for people who are earning between $50,000 and $92,000, and in the ideal world, we should see people moving out of NYCHA into these particular units, and then that creates additional units within NYCHA for the poor and the working poor.
This is the development of more housing towers in the lots now that are
in the lots that we're
public housing projects.
That is correct. And also a very unique project that we're doing in Staten Island with Markham Gardens, where again we're taking a look at some very, very old NYCHA stock that was in place and really built for a time-limited purpose for World War II. We've torn that down, and we're developing a mixed-use property for that particular community. So, again, we're trying to diversify the housing stock both for the working poor as well as make sure that people are getting access to the middle class.
Before we went on the air, there were some opening remarks by New York City Council Speaker Christine Quinn, and she referred to this NYCHA development program, I think, in ambivalent terms. Let's play a little of what Speaker Quinn said.
Urban America is not always part of the American agenda, and is not always seen by the folks in Washington from whom we desperately need help. You know, we had a hearing at the City Council yesterday about our housing authority, which is yet again in hundreds of millions of dollars of deficit, in part because the federal government has abandoned public housing, which puts all of us then in a situation where you have to choose, do you take $100 to $200 million from something else to stabilize public housing? You can't not stabilize public housing, but it puts us as urban leaders in a choice we, quite frankly, shouldn't have to be in.
So, Deputy Mayor, again, do you want to expand on that? And, you know, some people have responded to the idea, reacted to the idea of building new housing in the open spaces in public housing projects as kind of incredible, especially because part of the original design was that if people had to live in these tall towers, at least they would get some open space within that design.
Sure.
That was the original, you know, modern urbanism.
I totally agree with what the speaker said in the tape that you just played. I mean, we're being forced to make choices that we really don't want to make. I mean, the federal government basically has abandoned public housing, and this mayor has made a commitment to public housing and not selling off our public housing stock like other cities have done and tearing them down. And in addition to that, this mayor has made a commitment through capital investment to improve our stock. And there will still be open land, so we're really doing very targeted analysis as far as where there's space to build and not having fallow land basically just sitting idly by. And so I think the creation of open space is still part of our belief system, but in addition to that, we need to maximize it. We don't want to be in a position where we have our housing authority cutting into their reserves and continuing to have a deficit. We have to make sure that we structurally balance the housing authority budget, but at the same time, we need to make sure that the federal government and the state government step forward to honor their commitment to public housing as well.
Dan Cantor?
Last week, about 7,000 people actually held hands around Stuytown, an event called Hands Around Stuytown. I think really didn't get much notice. Only NYC actually covered it in any detail. But it's an interesting moment, right? The sale of Stuyvesant Town and the proposed sale of Star City have put this issue into public consciousness in a way it hasn't been before. Albany is considering a bill that would move Star City out of the grasp of the developers and keep it affordable forever. These are the kinds of real-life choices we need to make right now. The Bloomberg administration is to be lauded for its support for this kind of thing, as well as for its overall ambition, because I assume they fear they don't want to build 165,000 units over here and lose 300,000 units over here. So this, you know, God gave us brains for a reason, and we need to use them, not to just let the market decide, but to let the people decide through our democratically elected leaders. And that's what this whole idea of keeping the middle class and expanding who can make it into the middle class through job ladders, educational, vocational education, and so on, why it's such an important conversation.
Let's take another question from the audience. Over there on that side. Hi.
Yeah, good morning. A key issue of middle-class families is the quality of education. So I want to know, what is the direction that public education school systems must take in order to keep and attract middle-class families?
Okay, this is a big question, and it's one of the reasons we're so glad to have Deputy Mayor Dennis Walcott here today, because Mayor Bloomberg has said to judge him most of all on education. He said that right from the beginning of his term. And Deputy Mayor, you've been a point person on that. It's been 5 years now. How do you judge your own education reforms?
I think we're doing extremely well. I think we can do a lot better. Obviously, results have improved over the last 5 years. Basically, any indice you measure, you've seen the rates go up, whether they're graduation rates, whether they're English language arts scores, whether they're math scores. We've increased the number of AP advanced placement courses throughout the city. We've increased the number of gifted and talented programs to 175. We basically developed a uniform standard of what qualifies as a gifted, talented program. We've increased the number of schools throughout the city. In the past, when I was growing up, and a lot of us were growing up, people constantly talked about 1,200 schools in the New York City public school system. Now we have roughly 1,435 schools. Our schools are smaller, class sizes are smaller. The teachers are getting paid more than ever before, same with the principals. So, I mean, in a variety of areas, we're doing a lot better. We have the largest capital campaign in the history of the city, $13.5 billion. Our goal is to build roughly 100,000 new classroom seats by 2011. And so, again, I think we've done a tremendous job. But do we need to do a lot better? Sure. But I think the main thing, though, also with mayoral control is accountability. It's no longer like in the past, prior to 5 years ago when Andrea and I were at the old Board of Ed together, where people look for different points of who's responsible. You have one person, one deputy mayor, one chancellor responsible in dealing with accountability. And the other thing, while it's gotten a lot of attention, I think really was quite revolutionary, we've devolved more dollars to our schools directly, where schools coming this September will have more purchasing power than ever before, and giving principals the ability to use the dollars in a way they feel fit that fits their needs in a particular school.
That's what you call the empowerment schools.
Well, not just the empowerment schools. These are all the schools. You can go online and take a look at a school's budget, and you will see a net increase in a school's budget compared to the prior year, and schools will have the additional use of those dollars. And the empowerment schools that you're referring to, which come September will be roughly 485 or so, have even greater ability to be more independent.
Right, more decision-making power to the principal. Well, I have some stats here on the education progress. These come from The Economist, so if you want to dispute the stats, you can, but they're from The Economist magazine as they wrote them up. And I want to go down the panel briefly before we go to the next break and get your reactions to how the Bloomberg school reforms are doing so far. Is this where you wanted them to be 5 years out? But as The Economist lays it out, the mayor, among other things, set up 15 small high schools in 2002, an antidote to the big high schools where there was such a high dropout rate, and then got money from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation in 2003 to open 169 more. Last year, the first crop of small high schools had a graduation rate of 78% compared with 58% nationwide. The empowerment schools have also shown signs of success, this says, with better rates of attendance and grades. One more. Elementary school students have performed well in some local tests, it says, but their scores in national exams have hardly budged, which, of course, raises the question if the local tests are rigged. But let's go down the row. And Andrea Batista-Schlesinger, mayoral control, 5 years out, how are they doing?
Well, this is probably the single hardest system to try to change. And having sat on the Board of Education as a student, which then inspired my interest in public policy, it was very clear that something had to change. I mean, there's a reason that the average tenure, the last time I checked, of a big city school superintendent was about 3.5 years, because it's exceedingly different. And then re-election comes around, and then you've got to make change. And so, you know, I applaud the mayor for digging in, and Deputy Mayor Walcott for digging in. You know, I think there are more things we can do. I think, you know, we've got 34,000, 4-year-olds who need access to full-day pre-kindergarten. We still have after-school programs that need to be expanded. You know, we, regardless, and, you know, and I it's obvious that teachers are being paid more, but there's more we need to do to attract the kind of caliber of teachers we need in the subjects that are hardest to teach. You know, I'm worried about some of these principals of small schools who are being pushed up quickly and not supported enough and who will burn out. So, I mean, of course there are questions and there are concerns, but I have to say just, you know, the question of going back to a system in which the mayor isn't accountable is one that I don't think is in the best interest of New York City's middle class.
Nicole Gelinas?
I think the mayor's effort is certainly heroic, but I really think it's just far too early to tell, and you'll have to ask us in 15 years when these kids are competing in the marketplace for the first time, hopefully without government subsidy. Are we giving them the tools they need to make it on their own educationally?
We'll make a date. Dean Hochberg, can we all come back in 2022 and reconvene this panel? Dan Cantor, briefly.
I sort of agree with Nicole. I mean, I think it's, you know, Cho and Lai on the French Revolution. Too soon to tell. You know, the mayor, the schools are still pretty bad. Parents know it. There's two school systems. You know, if you're educated, you have money, you're white, whatever, you live in a good neighborhood, you can find a way to navigate through. If you lack some of those resources, it's pretty rough out there. The mayor's to be lauded for recognizing that, whether we as a society will decide that every child is actually, you know, deserves not just to be tested, but to, you know, to advance, remains to be seen.
We found one revolution
on
which.
Second. I mean, I agree with both Nicole and Dan in what they said about it's too early to tell as far as the overall success, because I think, you know, we're realists as well. The true measure will be when our students are graduating and they're competing for college and for jobs. I think, again, though, if you take a look at the immediate facts as far as whether it's graduation rates or scores, they are improving. If you take a look at our recent ELA scores, English Language Arts scores, they've grown higher than before. But still, I agree that the middle schools are an area that we have to tackle and tackle, I think, in a better way. And we are investing $40 million of new monies into the middle schools. I mean, since this mayor has been in office, and I think this goes with the accountability as well, we've increased the overall budget from city tax levy dollars by $4.5 billion. $4.5 billion. And the thing is, you have to make sure it's a wise investment as well. And even though Andrea talked about the newer principals, I think the challenge is the accountability of principals for their schools. And a principal is the person in charge of their building. They know their building best. They know their students best. And even though I don't necessarily say that it's all bad, I think you have a lot more better schools out there than ever before. And then dealing with the teacher allocation, I think this is the next challenge. It's going to be one of the most difficult challenges is teacher allocation, making sure that the schools in those districts that have had, for whatever reason, poor teachers in place, making sure they have the ability to have competition of teachers who are high quality, and having the principals now, as a result of both the teachers' contract and the principals' contract, which have the selection and not be forced to accept a teacher or an assistant.
Which principal. Certainly challenges the old seniority system of more experienced teachers being able to choose their schools. And we're going to be doing more on that just after the school year in July on some future programs. Brian Lehrer on WNYC will continue in a minute from the New School, our special edition on the viability of the middle class in New York City today. Stay with us.
Mayor Bloomberg has a very aggressive program, a goal of creating 165,000 new units of affordable housing. And we in the council are trying to do everything we can to support that, including thinking out of the box and using things like zoning. Upzonings in neighborhoods to create affordable housing.
City Council Speaker Christine Quinn speaking to this conference at the New School before we went on the air. She had given some opening remarks and something again that we're going to follow up on. Upzoning as a way to create affordable housing. Is zoning a tool that can be used to good effect? But today's event is a joint project of Milano, the New School for Management and Urban Policy at the Center for New York City Affairs, and is made possible thanks to the generous support of Altria, the Rockefeller Foundation, and Fannie Mae. Brian Lehrer on WNYC at the New School this morning with our guests, Deputy Mayor Dennis Walcott, Dan Cantor, founding executive director of the Working Families Party, Nicole Gelinas, senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute, and Andrea Batista Schlesinger, the executive director of the Drum Major Institute for Public Policy. Let's go to another question from the audience. Where are we? We have somebody with the microphone over there, right in the middle in the back. Hello.
Oh. Hi. It's clear that education is the key to opportunity, and Nicole mentioned opportunity. And my question is, how do you define opportunity, given that a majority of the children, and I think specifically about the Bronx, are still getting a substandard education?
I guess I'll tackle that one.
Deputy Mayor?
I think opportunity is preparing students to be well-versed in both the academics but also in real-world issues. And what I mean by that, making sure they have opportunity to select different options to schools, to make sure that career technical education programs are spread throughout the city, and making sure, like we just opened up a new school in Ozone Park called the High School for Construction Trades. We're providing meaningful career opportunities for those students who may not go on to college. What we did was broker a relationship with the trade unions, where the trade unions have guaranteed apprenticeships through our high school construction trades. I think making sure that students are able to take tests appropriately. For example, what we did is the city invested, I think, around $1 million or so, so that way every 10th and 11th grader could take the PSAT. And now, compared to where only 33% have been taking the PSAT in the past, now 75% of the students who are 10th and 11th graders are taking the PSAT, which is the next next step in taking the SAT and then moving on to college. So I think providing a foundation for our students to be prepared both academically but also knowing other parts of what's going on in the world allows them to take that next step onto college. And to me, again, I agree, not just in the Bronx, but throughout the city there are failing schools, and we're not waiting for the state to tell us to close schools. We're closing schools down. We're breaking them into smaller units. And as indicated by Brian from The Economist, what we're seeing is with those smaller schools, graduation rates are going up, attendance rates are going up, schools becoming more relevant. In the Bronx, for example, the old Walton High School, we broke up into four small schools. We're seeing better results at those four schools. In Morris Campus, we broke up. So a number of the big schools that were failing our students in the past, we're now breaking them up into smaller schools, and we're seeing a return on that investment.
Andrea, briefly.
I just wanted to say that I think there's a parallel here between tackling the school system and tackling this larger question of how we strengthen the urban middle class. You know, it's not something that can be done centrally from on high, one policy that can fix everything and that can make sure that we live in our equitable city or make sure that all of our schools are fixed. I mean, to some degree, it's represented in decisions that are made at the local level. You know, transformation in school systems happens school by school. The same thing is going to happen in our city, neighborhood by neighborhood. And the question is really going to be, to what extent are all the stakeholders at the table believing and understanding that each one of their decisions, whether it's about, and we often do this, you know, well, this is healthcare day, then we'll talk about taxes tomorrow, and then, you know, we'll have housing day on Thursday, to the extent that everybody who's invested in looking at those issues understands that, you know, we all have to come to the table to figure out how to strengthen the middle class in the city. And I think the same thing is going to happen with the schools. All of the stakeholders have to come to the table so we can figure out what to do, because there isn't a quick fix, just like there isn't a quick fix to the question that we're addressing here.
Okay, we have another question from the audience. Right in the front.
Hi, good morning. Several people have mentioned affordable housing and the need to preserve existing units to ensure that the middle class continues. My question is about NYCHA. What role can and should public housing play in our quest to save the middle class? Public housing is affordable housing, despite the public's perception that is concentrations of poverty.
Deputy Mayor, what about public housing in that, I guess we'd call it old sense, building public housing projects, because I guess when she talks about NYCHA, that's what she's talking about, as opposed to these newer models of inclusionary zoning where private developers have to include some affordable units and things like that?
Well, again, I think we in this administration, the mayor in particular, believes in public housing and what public housing represents, whether it's what Dan talked about in the mayor's advocacy around Mitchell Alma and the transfer and what's pending in Albany, or the investment in the NYCHA units itself, the New York City Housing Authority units, and making sure that we keep even rents, even though we raised rents last year, was to a very small targeted segment of the NYCHA residents who were above a certain income level, and so making sure that rents are affordable and that we constantly improve the housing stock within the NYCHA constellation. So we have a firm commitment to that. As far as the building of new NYCHA units, there really isn't the money there to do that. I think, again, the inclusionary zoning and the other approaches that the mayor and staff have talked about is a way to get private money invested and making sure that private money is also not just benefiting the rich, but also having poor or more affordable units built into it.
Next question from where's that microphone? Okay, all the way in the back. Hi.
How's everybody doing? I have a question. I think it's specifically for Nicole, but all you guys can answer. While building better ways of transportation can expand New York City and the middle class, won't that just continue the cycle of displacement? Like, for example, pushing out the working class in, let's say, Jamaica, Queens, or Bed-Stuy, so they can move to Staten Island?
I think if we increase the supply of housing through mass transit, just by definition, more supply would mean that prices are more rational. I certainly can't say some neighborhoods won't become more attractive, and of course then prices will go up, but that is just the reality of the marketplace. And even if we build 165,000 units of subsidized housing, that reality doesn't go away. There are just some lucky people who sort of win the affordable housing lottery. And another thing is, any improvements that we talk about in the city will, by definition, raise prices. What Mayor Giuliani did with crime raised prices in neighborhoods that formerly middle-class people did not want to live in. And it's the same with education reforms. if these reforms succeed and we are able to educate our children, they're going to be out working on Wall Street, working at hedge funds, making money, and they'll be pushing prices up in their own neighborhoods. Now, that to me would be successful, but some people might consider it a failure.
Somebody else wanted that? He directed it to many. Okay, and we're almost out of time. So let's get a closing word. We have about a minute left for a closing word from everybody. So give me big picture, Dan.
There are so many things we need to do. We're not solving these problems in silos. You don't solve the education problem without solving the housing problem, without dealing with mass transit, without dealing with the work and family dilemma itself. We need to support middle-class families in the raising of children. That's why the paid family leave thing that's on tap in Albany is so important. This is the right conversation. I do think we need to make these decisions in a democratic way.
Andrea, big picture, 15 seconds.
Got to get out of these old paradigms, taxes versus market, government versus – we've got to get out of these. Otherwise, there's no way that we can do the things that historically we have done to create a middle class and sustain it.
Nicole, 15 seconds.
What we haven't talked about is the forgotten taxpayer, the working class, middle class taxpayer who has to pay for all of these programs that chances are, just by the numbers, he or she will not be benefiting from. We want to level the playing field for everyone to compete fairly.
Deputy Mayor, 15 seconds.
The best is yet to come in education. I think we're laying the foundation for the New York City system to be a true shining star and making sure there are more options available for all students so that way they have equity in our educational system.
And that is it for today's show. We thank, from Milano, the New School for Management and Urban Policy, Dean Fred Hochberg, Associate Dean John Green, and from the Center for New York City Schools at the Affairs at the New School, Andrew White, Director Mia Lipset, and Carolyn Gillis. Engineering by Ed Haber, Damon Whittemore, Jocelyn Gonzalez, WNYC Event Planning by Brenda Williams-Butts, Robin Billenkoff, Shira Rosenhaft, Erica Edwards, and the WNYC Volunteers. This program was produced by Lisa Allison with Jim Colgan and Priya George, with help from Spencer Wilking and Nadia Zonis. The executive producer is Nuala McGovern. I'm Brian Lehrer. Please thank our guests.